I'm Scott.
I'm Bill.
And we're the Trade Guys.
You're listening to The Trade Guys, a podcast produced by CSIS where we talk about trade in terms that everyone can understand. I'm H. Andrew Schwartz, and I'm here with Scott Miller and Bill Reinsch, the CSIS Trade Guys.
In this episode, we talk about the findings from a USMCA dispute panel on Canada's tariff rate quotas in the dairy industry. We also discuss the latest controversy over Walmart pulling products from Xinjiang from their Sam's Club stores. We end the episode looking ahead to 2022 and predicting the biggest items on the trade agenda. Stay tuned for all that and more on this episode of The Trade Guys. Hello, happy new year to you both and to the audience. I hope you were both able to enjoy time with the family and not encounter too many supply chain issues with holiday shopping. How was your new year? How was your holiday season?
Excellent on both accounts, and supply chains didn't interfere with Santa, so that was good news on our end. So
we had a very modest Christmas and didn't give either of us much of anything. We didn't have any supply chain crises. But the big news today, if I can preempt Jasmine, is this is her last week with us. Jasmine is leaving CSIS, sadly, and moving off to the Big Apple to do other things. And we're going to miss her enormously. We also have to get a new producer, which we will work on. But Jasmine has been terrific as the voice of the Trade Guys, or at least the moderating voice of the Trade Guys. And so thank you, Jasmine, for everything that you've done. And we're going to miss you.
That goes double for me. You've been terrific behind the scenes as well as on the mic. So it's been a pleasure working with you.
Well, thanks for allowing me to be an honorary trade guy for a little bit. It's been great to chat and learn so much from both of you, and I'll definitely miss you and the podcast, but I'll be sure to be the number one fan of the Trade Guys.
That's right. You can now like and subscribe.
That'll be me. So first topic on the list, and I'll steal from Politico's headline today, no crying over imported milk. Back in May, the U.S. requested a USMCA dispute panel to be created after failing to resolve a dispute over dairy bilaterally with Canada. The panel's findings were made public yesterday, and it's the first dispute settlement panel ever brought under USMCA. Bill, I know you spoke with a reporter yesterday on the topic. What was the panel's decision?
Well, it looks like both sides are claiming victory. I think the way to look at it is that the U.S. won the battle. Canadians think they won the war. I think they may be putting a good gloss on it. There was a moment 5 years ago for about 10 minutes when I understood the Canadian dairy program. And it was explained to me in excruciating detail by a Canadian who was an agriculture expert, and I got it. And by the time I had gotten back to my office, I couldn't understand it anymore. But basically, Canada believes in supply management, which is that they try to manage the supply of, and therefore the price, of agriculture commodities by trying to influence production. Dairy is not the only case where they do this, but dairy has been a particularly controversial one because we have competitive dairy products, and they're right across the border. You know, big dairy states in the United States are Wisconsin, New York, and Vermont. So it's not a big schlep to get our dairy products from any of those places across the border. One of the things that was negotiated as part of USMCA was that the Canadians promised when they implement supply management tariff rate quotas, which means that there's a quota that comes in at either a low or zero tariff, but items that come in above the quota pay a higher tariff. It's called a TRQ. And what Canada promised to do was make its TRQ open to everybody, which functionally means U.S., you know, dairy product producers. Mexico's a little far away for that. So the U.S. complaint was that, in fact, the way the program worked was that Canada reserved between 80 and 85% of its TRQ allocations for Canadian processors, and therefore giving the foreigners, i.e. us, a very small share of the total. And the U.S. argued that that was illegal under Canada's commitments, that they had to open the TRQ process equitably for everybody and simply let the market decide who gets the shares of the TRQ. And on that point, the panel agreed with the United States and said that the Canadians cannot restrict access to the TRQ the way they have done. The Canadians claimed victory by arguing that the panel did not strike down the entire TRQ program. And therefore, the Canadian argument is that the panel sustained the fundamentals of Canadian supply management. My sense is that's an exaggeration. The United States did not contest the supply management program. They contested the Canadians' administration of this particular part of it, and we won on that. The panel did not rule on the supply management program as a whole because it was not being contested. So the Canadians are basically saying that, you know, because they didn't outlaw the whole program, we win. The reality was they didn't address the whole program. And on the issue that was under contest, the administration of the TRQ, the United States won. The good news, in addition to the fact that the panel system prevailed, they did it in 6 months, which is good. WTO should take a hint from that. The other good news is that the Canadian Trade Minister, Mary Ng, announced that Canada is going to comply. So that will save further litigation and further back and forth recrimination, which is good because we've got a whole boatload of these issues with Canada, lumber being another big one, paper being an older one. There's some on the U.S. side, you know, our Buy America rules and our electric vehicle tax credit, our Canadian complaints. So we have a lot of very specific bilateral issues with them. This one looks like it's on the way to resolution if the Canadians are going to comply. So good news. Good news for us. Good news for our dairy farmers.
Yeah, I agree. It's look, it's always good to see dispute settlement systems working as they're expected to. When the system works, that's generally reassuring to all the parties that basically agreed with to undertake the obligations of the trade agreement in the first place. I would point out that supply management really only exists, thanks to the GATT and other rules-based trading systems as they've expanded over the years. Supply management really only exists in agriculture. It's gone in industrial goods. That's probably a good thing because it turns out supply management is what they call it when the government's involved. It's called price fixing when the government isn't involved. Basically, this is a way to raise prices to consumers for the benefit of the producers. And a lot of agricultural commodities still maintain these systems. U.S. sugar would be an example of it. And it's a game that's rigged, but because the government itself is involved in the rigging, it seems to be okay. Now, having lived in Canada for 3 years when our daughters were small, I can guarantee it raises the price of milk. A lot of things in Canada are more expensive than the U.S. Milk is a lot more expensive. But for that, the only other comment I make is one of the things the supply management does is makes the industry focus principally on the domestic market. That's their concern. Managing that domestic supply becomes the principal sort of element in business success. And I think that tends to create a failure of imagination for the industry. Best example of this in the dairy business is to fly to any Caribbean country, Central America, anywhere south of the U.S.-Mexico border. And you'll find, go to breakfast, and on the table, there are little packets of butter. And everywhere I've been, at least in the Caribbean, which is a lot of places, the butter is from New Zealand. Now, I'd invite you to look at a map and look at the distance between that country and New Zealand versus either the U.S. or Canada. And what you'll find is that it's a lot closer. There's good reason that there ought to be competitive suppliers from North America to that nearby market. It's not the case, and it's probably because of supply management and the thinking that leads you to focus only on the domestic market, that New Zealand, which has a free market and a very export-oriented dairy industry, has managed to succeed very far away from home. They see the world as a market instead of seeing only their home country. But it is what it is. The programs have survived in a lot of places, including Canada and the U.S., and I don't expect them to change in the future, given the political effectiveness of maintaining them over the years.
Scott, do you have any insight as to why milk in Canada comes in bags?
Well, because there's no competitive pressure for other packaging. Now, the bags happen to be very low mass, so they'll claim an environmental benefit. But one of the oddest things we had to do when we started buying milk, it's literally in plastic bags. And so when you buy your first, 4-liter bag of milk, they come in 1-liter packet within the bigger bag. So it's a bag within a bag. And then you have to buy a little pitcher that is sold, usually hanging on a wire rack right next to the milk in the dairy case. And you buy one of those little plastic things which lasts as long as you're buying Canadian milk. But it's an odd, inconvenient mechanism. And as an old consumer products marketing guy, I can tell you it's because of the lack of competition that nobody really is interested in asking the consumer whether they'd like more convenient packaging. It's a very inexpensive method for the producer, but you have a system that soup to nuts favors the producers over the consumer. Therefore, milk is bagged.
Well, that was one of the things that I was always curious about and never had an answer for. I'm glad I can ask you about it.
This is true. In the U.S. is guilty of some of these same practices as well. Scott mentioned sugar, which is a classic example of our effort to maintain high prices here, which are generally substantially above the world price of sugar. And we saw it also conspicuously a few years ago, well, continuing in tomatoes and a case involving Mexican tomatoes. And there, the domestic industry, the U.S. industry, used our dumping laws to establish that the Mexican tomatoes were being dumped, meaning sold below the cost of production. But then what you can do under that law is you can negotiate what's called a suspension agreement, in which the government, in this case, the Department of Commerce, agrees to suspend its dumping investigation in return for certain commitments that the foreign, the exporters make. And of course, the commitment they make is price. And so basically what has happened more than once with Mexican tomatoes is that the domestic industry, the U.S. industry, is unhappy because the tomatoes are coming in. They either initiate or resume a prior dumping investigation. There's a negotiation and a new agreement is reached in which essentially the Mexicans agree not to sell their tomatoes below a certain price. So it is a price fixing agreement. And Scott's exactly right. We don't call it that in dumping parlance. We call it a suspension agreement. But the result is that people pay more for their tomatoes.
Well, at least for this dairy dispute, seems to be resolved for now. But our next topic is an ongoing issue that U.S. companies are dealing with when it comes to business in Xinjiang. Walmart, which owns Sam's Club, has been wrapped up in controversy after Sam's Club removed products sourced from Xinjiang in their stores. There was a lot of confusion and outcry on Chinese social media, and China's Central Commission for Discipline Inspection accused Sam's Club of, quote, stupidity and short-sightedness. What were your reactions to the issue?
Typical Chinese comment, always tactful and graceful. Sam's Club is stupid. That would be the Chinese reaction. This is a really important issue because it's going to affect a lot more companies than Walmart. And it's something that I'm happy we're talking about. What is interesting to me about it is that this particular controversy was occasioned by Chinese people, trolling through Sam's Club's offerings and noticing the absence of products from Xinjiang and then flagging that on the internet and flagging that publicly and of course flagging it for their government. So this means there's people in China that are watching very carefully to see how foreign companies are responding to the forced labor issue. And some companies, and I think one could legitimately say Walmart has tried to do this apparently unsuccessfully, have been trying to skate through this dilemma by simply taking actions and not telling anybody and hoping no one will notice. Because, the situation that retailers in particular find themselves in is if they don't market products from Xinjiang, they're criticized in China. If they do market products from Xinjiang, they're criticized in the United States. So no matter what they do, they're going to be criticized by somebody. And if they're big in both markets, as Walmart is, it is a real dilemma for them. And some companies have attempted to do this by taking public positions. H&M was a good example, the apparel company. We're going to try to, get Xinjiang cotton out of our supply chain. That got them in trouble in China and led to demands for, boycotting their products. At the same time, if they hadn't done that, they would have had similar criticism here in the United States. Walmart's strategy appears to have been to weed out the products but not mention it and hope that nobody noticed, which, I think was a smart strategy, except it didn't work. And what it has made clear is there are Chinese people who monitor this stuff very carefully. And they're going to be calling out companies that don't accept Xinjiang components and parts or don't accept products from Xinjiang. And that puts companies right in the middle of the dilemma that they face.
Yeah, it's really evident from this example that individual companies are really easy targets for governments because companies are generally in business to serve the local consumers. That's certainly the case with Walmart, both in the U.S. and all the countries where they operate. And any operating entity like Walmart China or Sam's Club China would be operating under the obligation to obey local laws. And they do operate within the law to the best of anybody's knowledge. Yet there is this catch-22 that they face. And sometimes producers experience the same thing. So I recall a situation with some concerns over sustainable lumber practices. And there was a very broad regulation about excluding certain kinds of lumber from your supply chain. Well, one of the companies that we dealt with was making rayon. And rayon is a product made from wood pulp. It looks like a textile. It's actually a non-woven. Despite its appearance, it's wood pulp that is the initial ingredient in making rayon. But if you look at a vat of wood pulp, you can't tell what the source of the timber is. And you certainly can't certify that you've excluded certain kinds of lumber from the pile of chips that you started with. So the compliance problems are ones that are very serious. And sometimes the product is such that there's not a practical way for you to comply. So it's a difficult problem for the producer to solve, but the consumer facing companies have a particular challenge because in this case you have not a regulation in China, but rather scrutiny by, let's call them patriotic Chinese consumers who are operating and reporting behavior that they don't like, not necessarily that is per se against the law, but one that Walmart and its suppliers are probably attempting to stay within U.S. law by doing this. So it's a very difficult problem. But so it's hard for companies to deal with, and companies themselves are quite vulnerable in these circumstances. But Bill's right. I think we ought to expect to see more of this. Life's going to be very difficult for companies. Particularly, I would say, tech companies who operate in China, because it's a large part of their revenue source. It's a big share of their total operations. And they'll be particularly exposed in these kind of situations because there aren't a lot of alternative supply networks.
Yeah, I know this case was of Chinese people noticing the absence of products in Chinese stores. But even in the U.S., I think that the typical shopper at Costco is a middle-aged Asian woman, age 39. And I'm not middle-aged, but I am an Asian woman. And the ability to purchase these Asian products at big retailer stores like Walmart, Costco, and Sam's Club is definitely a big draw for this group of consumers based in the U.S., and I think that companies will have a really hard time balancing not only their incentives to cater to Chinese consumers in China, but also Asian American audiences. So it'll definitely be interesting to follow. I know that Tesla has just opened a new showroom in Xinjiang's capital city. Do you guys have any reactions to that? Do you think that this is an intentional business decision on their part to capitalize on the market there?
Well, certainly the largest automobile market, for at least for new vehicles in the world, is China. It's roughly twice the size of either Europe or the U.S. The U.S. is still about 17 million cars a year, vehicles, and that's cars and light trucks. Europe is a little smaller than that, but I think China is over 30 million vehicles a year, and they are heavily promoting or subsidizing electric vehicles. So no doubt Tesla wants to be part of that market. Most companies who look at the world through a global lens definitely want to participate in the biggest market. So I don't know the specifics of how Teslas are made and whether they have this same kind of compliance issue that Sam's Club is facing, but it doesn't surprise me at all that they're engaging in the market.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I've been to Urumqi in Xinjiang province, and I guess the one thing I would say about it is it's not overcrowded with vehicles in the same way that Beijing or Shanghai are. So if you're looking for a growth market, that may be one, although they don't have the same population that either Shanghai or Beijing does either. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. As I recall, Tesla also has a factory in China. So I assume that the cars they'll be marketing there are cars that are manufactured in China. So they don't run afoul of the U.S. forced labor prohibitions because their product is not coming back here. So it's not an import. And I imagine, I mean, it'll be an interesting question. One would be whether the cars they make here have parts and components, and the obvious one would be batteries that come from China and particularly come from Xinjiang. I don't know the answer to that. I'm sure that somebody is going to ask. Somebody in the media will investigate and figure out where Tesla's batteries come from. I think they're trying to build them here, but I don't know if they've been totally successful with that or not. On the other hand, if they're making Teslas in China, there's a very high likelihood that the batteries in those cars are Chinese, and therefore also a likelihood that the batteries contain components that come from Xinjiang. That won't get them in trouble in China. The question is whether, you know, people here in the United States that are concerned about company purity, for lack of a better term, will pick up on that and criticize Tesla, even though we're not talking about imports. It plays into the decoupling debate, you know, that we're heading into anyway. And this is a case where both governments are heading down a road that's going to force companies to choose, even though the United States in particular says we don't want to force you to choose. In effect, they are, you know, by not letting in products that are made with forced labor, you are telling companies you need to make choices. And when the Chinese essentially say the reverse, you have to respect our laws, you know, and use products that are made in Xinjiang or made by forced labor, it puts companies, particularly consumer-facing companies, as Scott said, in the position of having to choose. And they all hate that because it means giving up business. Choosing, by definition, it means giving up some business. But I think this is the direction we're heading in, and companies increasingly are going to be forced to make a decision. Do you want to stay in one place or the other? Because you can't stay in both.
I'm sure that there will continue to be updates, and the list of U.S. companies, European companies, will continue to grow, and we'll just have to keep following and see what happens. But let's end today's episode by looking ahead to this year. What do you both think will be the most pressing trade issue to resolve?
Well, let me start. I've given some thought to this. So one of the things I think is going to emerge as a big issue in 2022 is now just sort of a theoretical conflict. But for me, there's a conflict between what countries like the United States and also the European Union want to do with regard to trade rules affecting climate policy, and the conflict between that policy initiative and the existing trading system. So you have the rules-based system, which has some very clear prohibitions on industrial subsidies and on something called product and process methods. So it's how a product is made versus what a product is. And production and process measures are generally restricted in the WTO disciplines and most trade agreements, that you regulate it because it's a widget, and widgets are all the same no matter how they're made and the methods under which they're produced. So those two will be in direct conflict. Those two principles that are deeply embedded in trade agreements will be in direct conflict with some of the policy ideas that are being expressed to decarbonize or to help toward the climate goals. For me, I think it's natural they'll be in conflict, and I want to see it arise. But so that's the one thing I'm watching. The second thing is really whether the Biden administration moves toward trade as part of a growth agenda. I'm looking at the recent polling, and I think that there's a desperate need for economic growth. Recently, this week, in fact, the CNBC poll showed that the president's disapproval rating had reached 56%. If you look at the internals of the poll, the number one issue is as usual, the economy, jobs in the economy. And the president's rating on the economy is 60% disapproval. So this is something that for the president to remain effective as a leader, I think it's urgent that it gets turned around. And at the moment, most of the economic initiatives of the administration are in the climate space, in the regulatory space, or even the worker-centric parts of the trade agenda that we've seen so far, Buy America and steel tariffs, tend to work in the wrong direction of economic growth, tend to increase sort of also the wrong, directionally wrong for controlling inflation. So I think the administration is going to need a growth agenda, and I'm hoping that trade is a part of that agenda because it's a very logical and beneficial component if it's focused on. So those are the two things. So sort of how climate policy and trade policy do or don't conflict in the next year, and when the administration makes a pivot to growth, how is trade a part of that?
I had thought about it in more micro terms and macro terms, but picking up on Scott, I think we need, in a subsequent podcast, I think we can do a deeper dive into the climate issue, because there's a lot to be said about that. I've been of the view for a long time that the difference that Scott has described, which is a true one, can be reconciled. And I don't think it has to be an obstacle to a constructive climate mitigation policy that stays within the boundaries of WTO rules. That doesn't mean that there aren't going to be a lot of proposals that don't stay within the boundaries. There already are. And it doesn't mean that there aren't going to be a lot of people that don't care about the boundaries. At CSIS, the Scholl Chair in particular, spent a lot of time simply trying to get environmentalists and trade wonks into the same room to talk to each other. And in the process, we've discovered, first, that they don't speak the same language, which is one of the purposes of the meeting. But the other is that there is a tendency on the trade side to say, rules are rules, and you ought to design your program to adhere to the rules. There's a tendency on the climate side to say, this is a crisis, it's so important, you need to bend the rules in order to accommodate what we want to do anyway. So there's legitimate issues there. I think, you know, navigation is possible. And we should spend more time in a future episode talking about that. On Scott's second one, I agree wholeheartedly. And one of the things that we both talked about in the past that has baffled me is the administration's lack of interest in market access. You know, market access is the fancy term for exports. And there's a whole bunch of people in the United States who want to sell more stuff, beginning with farmers, but not limited to farmers. And I've always thought of exports as win-win. You know, they decrease the trade deficit, they increase jobs, they increase income, they increase growth. I mean, it's very hard to find something negative about exports. And the administration seems, beyond lip service, relatively uninterested in doing things that will promote that. Instead, they would rather focus, as Scott said, on areas that are not growth-inducing and that might actually be inflationary. So, you know, figuring out whether they'll figure that out and move forward is a really big question. It's compounded by my own frustration, which is that this is taking a lot longer than it ought to. You know, even now, nearly a year into, you know, 2 weeks shy of a year into this administration, you still find major trade policy decisions under review, quote unquote. And it raises the legitimate question, you know, is how long does it take, you know, to figure out what to do? And what opportunities are being missed by not making any decisions? And that gets back to the export market access issues. You know, our place is being taken by other countries. The Washington Post this morning had a little editorial about the fact that RCEP, the Asian Cooperation Agreement that includes China, went into effect at the beginning of the year. And the editorial talked about the extent to which China is going to be able to use that to replace the U.S. presence in other Asian markets. That's something we ought to be worried about for strategic reasons as well as economic reasons. And I don't see any sense of alarm about that.
Scott, do you have any predictions about what the broader U.S.-China relationship will look like?
I'm concerned about the level of tension that exists already. And look, I'm hoping for some revisions in attitude that will allow for at least something like coopetition. You know, we're gonna compete in some areas, but there are other areas where I think it's in both nations' interest to cooperate. We haven't found it yet. My guess is that it goes well beyond trade policy, but I think that finding that solution is a pretty pivotal one, and I don't see it yet, at least not in U.S. policy.
That's the first time I've heard coopetition. It's a good word. But Yeah, even though today is my last podcast, I'm sure that there will always be new trade news to follow and many more podcasts. So I'll definitely tune into future episodes. And I hope you both know that I'll be your number one fan.
We do. And that's the wonderful thing about trade, as I've said frequently. No problems are ever solved. So there's always a lot to talk about. So farewell to Jasmine. And for the rest of you, we'll see you next week.
Thanks for everything.
If you have a question for the Trade Guys, write us at tradeguys@csis.org. That's tradeguys@csis.org. We'll read some of your emails and have the Trade Guys react to it. You've been listening to The Trade Guys, a CSIS podcast.